Welcome back to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. We are an interdisciplinary group of Christian scholars dedicated to the themes of tradition, place, and things divine. To learn more about us, our programs, our peer-reviewed journal Pietas, this podcast, and our annual conference, please go to ciceroniansociety.org. I'm Chris Annadale, and I'll be hosting this episode. My guest today is Caleb Galloway of Galloway Woodworks in Marietta, Georgia. Caleb, welcome.
How's it going?
Going really well. Thanks a lot. I appreciate you coming on the show here. I wanted to talk with you about a couple of things involving especially your woodworking. And I'll mention for the sake of the audience that I found out about you just by stumbling across some of your posts on Twitter, which I guess I'm going to keep calling that Twitter just because I'm an old man. But you have a website there, a site on Twitter, Galloway Woodworks, where you post some of your work. And you describe yourself as an Anglican woodworker and a stained glass artist. And my commissions are currently closed, but should reopen soon. Will you be doing commissions anytime soon, you suppose?
I hope to. Right now, I'm in the process of moving to a larger shop space. I'm renting out, well, I'm currently working out of my basement, and I have enough like physical space, but I don't have a ton of amperage just electricity. So I've been blowing the breaker a little too often. So I'm in the process of moving to a new shop. But once I get settled in there, I definitely will start looking around for more commissions.
Is woodworking, is this your 100% job? Is this a side hustle? Is it a hobby?
It's a full-time job now and has been for the better part of, I'd say, about a year.
And does it pay the bills?
For the most part, yeah.
Well, that's great. That's good to hear. How'd you get into that then? I mean, how do you set up as a sort of independent woodworker in your garage?
So, well, at the time I was going to architecture school, and they had a really, really nice wood shop set up in the basement of the architecture building. And the main thing that drew me to it was they had a CNC machine, which is, it's sort of the opposite of a 3D printer. It's like a three-dimensional carver, basically. So you put a block of wood on it and it will carve the shape that you tell it to carve. But they taught me kind of the basics of 3D modeling, that kind of thing. And the next, and well, yeah, so the, you know, through architecture school, I learned the basics of 3D modeling and was kind of figured, like, you know, it wouldn't be that difficult to just apply that to the CNC machine. I didn't have any real experience in woodwork, but I figured, you know, if you could 3D model it, the CNC can do 90% of the work, and then it's just sanding and whatnot from there, and I can probably figure that out. So one thing led to another, and I saw a post on Twitter from Father Brandon of St. Mark's Anglican Church. He's in California. But he had this little triangular space above the door of his church. And there was siding on it, and the siding just needed to be torn down. I think it was rotting out or something like that. But he was looking for something to put up there. And his plan was doing a crucifix, something like that. But he was kind of asked some other people. And I was like, you know, that's not a huge space. So I reached out to him and just said, I could probably carve some kind of relief to put up there. You know, full disclosure, I don't really know what I'm doing, but I can probably figure it out. And we agreed that he would cover the cost of materials and and postage. And I would, you know, figure out how to carve it. And that was kind of my first serious project in woodworking. It was kind of a three-part relief with the Christus Victor icon and then kind of some various kind of florals on either side. And then from there, I posted about that kind of as I did the project. Father Brandon was very supportive and, you know, reposted everything. And that kind of got me from, you know, a little, you know, Twitter account just to, you know, talk about politics and that kind of thing to being, you know, like, I think it was a 200-ish, but I was, you know, I was slightly noticed by some of the Anglican world. And that kind of got me into woodworking. I really, really enjoyed that project. And kind of as I was finishing that up, my priest, Father Tony, needed some help cleaning out the church basement and kind of redecorating it. They're kind of turning it into a prayer space and office. And I just reached out and said, you know, hey, you know, here's something I've done with this, you know, big relief. And, you know, if you wanted something maybe like that for the basement, I could probably do something. And he just texted back with just the words, call me. So I called him, we met up, and he wanted to do an altarpiece for our church. And what we ended up settling on was it's 7 feet tall and 6 feet wide, but just two giant panels of florals with a 5-foot Celtic cross in the middle. And that was kind of the second big project. And as I was doing that, that kind of people started to reach out and be like, hey, where's your website? Where can I buy your stuff? And eventually I was like, all right, well, I could probably make a little money off this. So I started hand carving some little Celtic crosses. Being the broke college student, I just didn't have a ton of money, so I picked up just a pair of basic chisels from Rockler and started carving some little crosses. Made a few hundred bucks from that in a couple months, and then I was like, well, that's enough money for a table saw. So I started fishing around to see if I could find somebody who wanted to buy a door, because I figure, if you have just a table saw and some very basic hand tools that I borrowed from my dad, I figured I could probably build a door. So after a little bit of fishing around, I found somebody who wanted a pair of tiled wood doors, and it would pay, and we settled on a price. It was, enough to cover, enough for me to, justify buying a table saw, as I can finish this, and then that'll cover more equipment down the line. And that was kind of my first, real paid project. And then from there, it's kind of the rest is history. By the time I finished that up, I had two other commissions, and it just kind of kept coming, going from there.
Are CNC machines difficult to acquire? Do you have your own?
Actually, well, they are somewhat expensive. They're getting consistently cheaper, which is good. But the cheapest one on the market of the size I wanted was about $3,500, which isn't terrible, but a little bit outside of my budget. But I had a friend who was in the electrical engineering program at my college, and we got to talking, and he'd built 3D printers, that kind of thing, before. And he was like, it's not that much mechanically different from a 3D printer. It's just bigger. And it's, you have a, instead of having an extruding head on the end, you just have a router head. So we went back and forth and about it, and eventually we started to put together. We found an online design from V1 Engineering on how to basically just build one yourself. And after a little bit of back and forth work, we pretty much ended up just building our own. It's a 4x8 bed, and kind of the goofiest thing about it is that a typical CNC runs a spindle, which is basically a very high-powered motor to spin the carving bit. The thing with spindles is that they're very heavy and they're somewhat difficult to like all wire together. But what we ended up getting was a trim router, which is basically just a very small spindle, clamped it onto the CNC and just used that as our spindle head, which has worked remarkably well, though it is somewhat janky. The one issue with it is trim routers are not built to run for 4 or 5 hours at a time. They're meant to, you hold it in your hand and you just pass it over wood, and you would never run it for more than, an hour at most. But we started with using Makita trim routers, and they would last for about 3 months before they'd burn out. And then we discovered Bauer trim routers will burn out in 2 months, but they have a 3 month warranty. So I ended up picking one up just to see, because they were cheaper. So I figured, it's about half the price, so even if it doesn't last as long, it'll be okay. But it burnt out before the warranty was up, so I took it down to a Harbor Freight. I was just like, look, so I'm totally abusing your system, but do you mind if I do? And the guy up front thought it was hilarious, and I think I've traded in the same trim router 3 or 4 times now.
Oh boy. Okay. Wow. What I was thinking of these very, you described these very large 7 foot, 5 foot large things. Do you manufacture them in panels and then glue the panels together?
Usually, yes. The big one that I did for Christ the King was just two big panels, which is not the way you should do it. It probably would have made more sense to do them smaller panels, but in this case, it worked very well. There's actually the reason you shouldn't do it is because it's a ton of CNC time, and the panels tend to warp. If you carve away a lot of the wood, that wood's going to want to move and bounce back. And the bigger the panel is, the more movement you're going to have. So I had to do a little bit of kind of recarving because the panel warped as it was being carved, but it wasn't too bad. And there's actually a new rule at my college because of it, because the first two panels were 14 hours each, and now there's a rule that for personal projects, you have to have a 4 hour time limit now because of me. But that was kind of what got me into building my own CNC and starting to kind of scale it out as a genuine business.
As far as a lot of this goes, have you been mostly self-taught or building off of things you've gotten from college, or are there any individuals you've learned from or learned to imitate or model yourself on?
Carpentry was, for the first probably I'd say year and a half, I was pretty much entirely self-taught. I would, occasionally ask for help from some of kind of the lab techs at my college, but really pretty much was entirely self-taught. But after About a year or so of working, I picked up a job with Orthodox Masonry. They are also on Twitter and are fantastic. But they're up in Vermont, and I worked with them for 2 or 3 weeks, something like that, one summer, and learned a whole lot from them. Yeah, so as far as people who have taught me, they're definitely top of the list.
Has most of the work you've been doing been church work? Is there a lot of church work out there, or
Yeah.
do you think that there's space to expand for another market?
Oh yeah. Well, I think it's kind of a mix. So particularly within the Anglican world, there is a lot of church work. There's tons of it. The issue is a lot of it doesn't pay that well, and that's of course there's nothing wrong with that, but that is kind of the just kind of how it is. But what I usually do is I'll do like two or three secular projects, and then I'll do a church project, and I'll usually make less money on the church project, but they're exceptionally fun to do, and they always do kind of bring in more clients. But I usually kind of rotate between the two. Yeah.
Do you find there's a balance in your work you have to hit between doing quality work and doing efficient or economical work?
Oh,
How
yeah.
do you work that out on a job basis?
Yeah, definitely. It's mainly just kind of you have to, it's just a matter of setting price more than anything. It's the higher the quality of the work, the higher you need to charge. And that's kind of probably the biggest learning curve to any kind of like self-manufacturing business is figuring out, how do I figure out a number and how do I, get that number to the client quickly and manage to like maintain that number is, working for me through the course of the project. Yeah. But other than that, it's really just kind of a function of, the benefit of, being young and not really having much else going on other than carpentry is that it's easy to just, spend, put, everything into a project. And, that's kind of the main, solution to that kind of thing.
Now you're working with your hands, you're making a physical product, but you're also on Twitter, you also talk about getting in touch with people this way. What's been the balance between the sort of the personal hands-on and the digital? How do you work in that space?
It's really just a matter of kind of you have to put the physical stuff first, and it's kind of the as far as I'm concerned, the Twitter only exists insofar as it enables me to continue doing the physical stuff. I need to be able to find a client and get commissions, that kind of thing. And the whole and the reason I've kind of stayed on Twitter for as long as I have is really just that it's been, it's, I'm, that's always been a means to an end of just, how can I get to the next, cool project.
Have you found a sense of community or a source of meaning in the kind of work that you've been doing?
Oh yeah,
Or is it
absolutely.
kind of isolating?
Oh, it's not isolating at all. It's a lot of the community is, it's kind of a mix of things. It's, part of it is just through Twitter. You meet a lot of very interesting people on there. I've worked, you work for some kind of, very kind of entertaining people. But it's also one of those things, like I think any like young man who's like, struggling socially, like, I found like the best thing you can do is to work with your hands, because even if you're doing it like completely solo, like I am, you have just like a cool picture to show somebody, and that alone can help you just with making friends, making conversation, that kind of thing.
I have a friend who's a farmer. He's a bit older than you, but we've had conversations before about the difference between sort of being good at farming and then being good at the business of running a
Oh
farm.
yeah.
Have you found that there's a similar kind of, woodworking versus the business skills necessary to actually sell and work with clients and set prices and
Oh yeah.
deliver and source materials, et cetera?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's one of those things about I'm a better carpenter than I am a businessman, but I think I've been, slowly picking that up and improving it as I go. But there's definitely it's definitely a struggle to learn to balance the two. Especially early on, you kind of have to learn that, like, you have to learn to set a high price for yourself. And that's not always the easiest thing to do, but once you kind of figure out how to do that, then you can re really all you have to do is just to focus on being a really, really good carpenter, and the business side will kind of sort itself out, as long as you can just set a reasonable price.
Yeah, I saw online you'd posted something on Twitter about, creating a manufacturing job for yourself, which seems like that's just kind of what you've done. You sort of willed into existence, Galloway Woodworks, and it's working well enough for it to be a full-time job for you right now. Do you think that's the kind of thing that other people could approach with a similar skill set?
Yeah, definitely. I think there's a lot of, especially nowadays with social media, kind of, I think in the past, kind of the biggest difficulty was, finding someone to sell to. But nowadays, that's, easier than ever. So I think that It is, it's not, it works particularly well if you're, single, living alone, and kind of just can just, pour your heart and soul into it. But I think there's a lot of merit to just kind of pushing out and finding just kind of a niche for yourself. Absolutely.
How far do you think your current arrangement could scale up before you'd have to begin thinking about, no, I need to turn away clients, need to do less work? I mean, how much bigger do you think you could grow what you're doing now?
I mean, well, I already am, turning down and giving away clients, a fair amount, but right now I think I've kind of hit the upper limit of what one person can physically do. And I think kind of the next stage will be to, move into a new space. And then probably once I have college finished, my hope is to probably hire some people and then just start moving this forward as just kind of a larger scale business.
That sounds like another skill set, besides,
Oh,
right?
yes,
And the
sir.
supervising people or
Yeah.
training people as well.
Absolutely.
Well, let me ask you a more general kind of social political question. I mean, you're a young guy, you're in your early 20s, and I'm in my 50s. So I'm a Gen Xer talking to a Gen Zer, and there's been a lot of discourse the past year, the past couple of months, especially about the economic prospects of young men in America today, and the sort of attitude they take, whether it's bitterness or hope or whatever, what some combination of them. Where do you come down on that, sort of emotionally, and also in terms of what kind of advice you'd give to men in your position?
Absolutely. Well, I think that you have to, and I think this is something that a lot of kind of the older generation doesn't do, is you have to differentiate between like what is good personal advice and what is good political advice. A good example of this is I think a while ago there was, some kind of Twitter discourse. I think it was Casey, but somebody posted a picture of a house that was, I think it was like 90, it was like a 6-bedroom house, it was like $90,000. And they were just like, this is like a really good fixer upper, buy the house, get a job at, the local Dollar Tree, and raise your six kids. And young men were just, completely outraged about it. And there later came out that the house was like at one point a meth lab or something. I don't know exactly how true that was, but that was what people were saying. But I think that is good personal advice. Like the simple reality is that nobody, you can't sit around and wait for someone to save you. You're going to have to find a way to make it work. And that's going to be different for everybody. For me, post college, I may well, find somewhere where land is cheap. Buy an RV, live out of the RV while I build a shop space, and then build a house after I have a shop. And I think there's, then just, and that's not, ideal. It would be nice if there was, reasonably affordable, housing or shop space, where I am, but I don't think that's just not really the reality. But I think that the issue, but the thing that I think a lot of the older generation kind of does is they give good personal advice, where it's, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, do the hard thing, because simply there's nothing else to do. You're going to do the hard thing, or you're not going to do anything at all. But I think that politically, that's become kind of like the go-to answer of bootstraps, bootstraps, bootstraps. And it's great personal advice, but if a politician goes to voters and says, I'm not going to help bootstrap, just bootstrap yourself up, I think the young voters are like, okay, well, bootstrap yourself into office. Like, it's, I'm, if you don't want to help me, I have no moral obligation to help you either. And I think there's, and that's something, I can empathize with a great deal of, I think that the personal advice is very solid, but I think that politically there needs to be a greater move towards, A, just recognizing that it is that it is in fact a problem. Yes, the bootstrapping is necessary, but it's only necessary because the problems exist. And then secondly, just recognizing that, the only way that this is going to be fixed at a systemic level is for the politics to be involved. But yeah, that's pretty much where I would sit on all that.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good response. That sounds very good to me. Now you're in Marietta, Georgia, suburban Atlanta. I used to live down there decades and decades ago. But let's suppose here, I'm just sort of looking forward 10 years, 20 years, right? You leave Atlanta, you go to some place. It could be Iowa, could be Kentucky, anywhere else. Find a place, set up a shop. Is that where you put down roots, or do you think that you'd be looking back at Marietta and saying, no, I really am, in a sense, still Caleb from Marietta? Would you expect maybe your children potentially to have a different attitude towards their hometown and roots than the one that you're able to have in this hypothetical future?
Yeah, I think for me, the main goal would be, even though I probably will move farther out, I would want to stay within reasonable distance to my family, so 2, 3 hours, where I can still maintain a relationship to Marietta and all the great people I know here, and maybe moving farther out to say like Canton, North Georgia, or maybe even as far as Alabama. There's plenty of relatively cheap land there. But I think the real trick with it is, I think there's a lot of, and kind of back on the political side, there's a lot of the push to just, find some place, far out, in the middle of absolute nowhere. That's going to be, and there, build your life there. And I think that's, I think that sh in general shouldn't be done. I think the goal should be, okay, I have this budget. What can I get within this budget that is, as close to, as possible to what I want? And the ideal for me would probably be, to be slightly outside of Marietta, a little bit farther out to the country. And I may go, 2 or 3 kind of rings farther out than that. But I think that the, let's see. Yeah, but I think that the trick to it is not to, move, 1,000 miles away to Iowa, but it's to find, what's the closest thing. Because I think that if you take it from the example of I'm just going to find the cheapest possible spot, I mean, at that point, you may as well just, leave America altogether and move to Mexico, where the land's even cheaper. But, that's, but I think that you do have to still, make an effort to maintain the roots as, as much as is economically possible.
Yeah, that tracks my experience as well. I grew up in DC suburbs and moved
Oh,
to a
yeah.
couple different urban centers, and then have been living rural areas for the past 20 years and more of
Right.
my life. That's kind of where I'm settled now. It
Yeah.
almost feels to me like you need to find a place that's small enough and cheap enough that you can live there, but that's, how do I say this? It's the kind of place where you could actually hope to put down roots and have some hope of defending them.
Oh
You know,
yeah,
in the sense that
absolutely.
it's not overly commercialized and urbanized, in the sense that it's beyond
Yeah.
your reach in one generation to actually establish a kind of identity. Does that fit with some of your thinking?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, it's kind of the hard thing of it is that, the move of progress kind of always continues, and the sticks rarely stay the sticks. I've read a lot of, he wrote a Jaber Crow, that kind of whole series of novels. And
That's Wendell Berry, I think.
Wendell Berry, yeah, that's right. But I think that, you do have to kind of find, someplace, decent, and then start, doing your best to defend it. And I think that a lot of the way that's going to be done is to get involved with politics on a very, very local level of, city councilor, mayor, that sort of thing. And then, start from there. And, and once you're in, some sort of position of very local political power, then you kind of have a hope of defending, wherever you've made roots.
Two more questions, if you don't mind. One, if somebody, sort of a bootstrapper Gen Xer like me, started pointing to your case and said, "Hey, look, young men, what you can do, you can build your own CNC machine, you can sell things to people on Twitter and find clients." Is that the kind of advice that you think could be generalized to other people's cases? Could people e fairly easily follow your path?
I think to a degree, yes. It only works if you actually like obsessively love the work. And that I think that there's some sort of skill that everyone can obsessively love. That might not be carpentry for everyone, but I think that generally, yes. But I think that it is highly dependent on the person to be, because not everyone wants to be, ridiculously entrepreneurial and, do the, it's not the necessarily the easiest path. But I think that at a general level, like, I wouldn't say it's good general advice, but I think it's a good option for a lot of young men to have. But it's not something that I would necessarily recommend to everyone.
Oh, that makes sense. I mean, there's going to be no one silver bullet solution for the
Oh, of
entire
course.
generation of 20-something men. But it's great to see you doing so well with
Oh,
what
yeah,
you are
definitely.
doing. I wanted to wrap up by asking you about a project that I've been following on your Twitter for a little while, which is this project of mass producing some roadside shrines. I wonder if you can tell us about that project, its origin, and its prospects as of now.
So that really kind of came apart, just on Twitter. People were, and a lot of it just came about. It's kind of like the general, philosophy of, finding a place to stay and defending it. And I think a lot of the way that's done is through sort of like a parish nationalism. Like, basically, it's like the degree to which, like, you can love your country, because particularly America is so big and culturally diverse. I don't think there's any one person who really loves their country. They love their little part of the country that they're connected to. And that's a good and right thing. And I think it's important to kind of support and emphasize that, especially kind of in the online age. It's very easy for America to just be some sort of vague collection of ideologies that everyone says everyone holds to, instead of, no, there's this very particular spot that I like that I'm willing to defend. And I think it's important to kind of move more in that direction. But I've got a couple of great partners that I'm working with. We're gonna CNC carve all the crosses or crucifixes ourselves, and then kind of have a nice little sort of open box to put them in just to protect them from the rain. But the
So
idea
they'd
is
be a
that,
couple of feet high and a couple of feet wide.
yeah, I mean, it should be the box itself. I think it's about a foot by a foot, about a foot by 2 foot, I'd say. So, you know, a nice little shrine that can just be mounted on a fence post, the wall of a church, anything like that. But that'll just be the idea to just to kind of, further, increase kind of the amount that we can sort of make something, a real, place that's worth loving.
How many of these are you thinking of producing? Like on what time scale?
Yeah, well, we hope to have kind of the first half dozen done by mid-January. We've got most of the design work kind of figured out, and we're going to do kind of a half dozen as kind of our first run, just to see what sales look like, and also just to kind of get our how we package them, how we produce them, just kind of streamlined. And then once we have that done, we hope to start doing them by the dozen and just doing drops. So I'll do so we'll make a dozen over 2 weeks. We'll post a link, say, hey, they're back here, go and grab one. And then when those sell out, we'll do another, dozen or 2 dozen if they sell well enough.
Sounds great. I hope that works out well.
Yeah, looking
It
forward
sounds
to it.
almost like you took what was initially a sort of nostalgia post on Twitter. Somebody posted a photo of a
Yeah.
roadside shrine and said, "Hey, why don't they do that anymore?" And you and some other people grabbed onto it and said, "Hey, we're going to do this,
Yeah. I mean,
now
yeah,
and in the
the kind of the
future."
trick is, you can't just do things. If the nostalgia posting is something I have mixed views about, because it's, I think it's good to like remember those kind of things, but it's important to take that not just as things were so much better back then, but to take it as a call to action of, here's, maybe we can't fix the entire thing. Here's one, little drop in the bucket that was nice 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 200 years ago. Let's just bring that back now. And then, if you do that enough times, eventually, you'll have a much better world.
Great. If people wanted to follow this project or maybe get hold of one of these, would they go to a your website or to your Twitter? How should they follow up on this?
Yeah, so just follow me on Twitter. I'm in the process of setting up a proper website for this project specifically, and I hope to have that link live probably by the end of December, as we start to move forward with getting the first half dozen done and ready to ship.
Sounds great. Okay, on Twitter, you're Galloway Woodworks, and I'll post a link in the show notes for this
Fantastic.
episode. So that's fantastic. Any other big projects coming up? Anything on the scale of the altarpiece you're speaking about before?
Yeah, that's kind of, well, the next really big project will be working for my main church's church plant, Incarnation Anglican Church, up in Canton. But they need a new altar. And hopefully, probably after I have this roadside shrine project wrapped up, and kind of, well moved along, that'll be kind of the next big thing. The plan is to do a series of panel, like each panel of the altar will be inlaid with various wood types to show different biblical scenes related to the incarnation. And that's kind of the next big stage of things we hope to do. A lot of extremely ornate inlays, hopefully do some gilding, three-dimensional carving pieces on it, as well as probably some brass inlays as well.
Wow, sounds fantastic. That's good. Well, it looks like you've created a sort of very interesting, very rewarding, personally and maybe financially niche for yourself in terms of doing this woodwork at a very young age. I'm really, really glad to have spoken with you about all this.
It was nice to speak to you as well.
So, thanks very much, Caleb.
Awesome.
You've been listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. To learn more about us, to sign up for our mailing list, or find out about our upcoming events, please go to ciceroniansociety.org. And thanks again to Caleb Galloway of Galloway Woodworks for being our guest for this episode.
Yeah, thank you.
Right, bye-bye.